This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the Q interview from CBC Podcasts and from Q on CBC Radio 1. If you've listened to the podcast before, you'll know that I don't really sound like Tom Power, and that would be a very apt observation because I am, in fact, not Tom Power. This is Tom's good buddy, Caitlin Swan, as Tom would say, the pride and joy of Saskatchewan. Basically, I produce this whole podcast thing, and Tom, he's away on holidays. So, while Tom is away, I am keeping the home fires burning. I've gone to the Q interview vault and picked out a good one, if I do say so myself. If you love a versatile actor, an activist that refuses to quit, and an endlessly fascinating person, well, this one is for you. From 2020, this is Tom Power's conversation with the legendary actor Jane Fonda.
Did you ever imagine in your 80s that you'd be spending the night in jail?
Well, I never imagined I'd live this long. If I'd ever imagined I'd live this long, I would have figured I'd go to jail. Women get much feistier and braver when they're older.
I mean, you write about being the kind of person who walked the walk, you cut back on red meat, you got an electric car, but then something changed and convinced you to ramp up your own climate activism. What was that?
A year ago, I was in Big Sur with friends, and I read a book by Naomi Klein. She's a Canadian.
She certainly is, yeah.
All of her books have a huge impact on me and my life, but her last book is called On Fire, A Burning Case for a Green New Deal. That's what I needed to get me off my duff and into action. I knew that I needed to do more. I started reading the science and realizing that the window of opportunity, you know, it's closing that window. We have to work real fast. Greta Thunberg inspired me by her putting her body on the line.
Our house is still on fire. Your inaction is fueling the flames by the hour.
And so that made me realize that what I wanted to do is put my body on the line. I'm a celebrity. I'll raise a lot of attention that way.
When did that start? Take me back to the roots of your activism. What's your earliest memory of being so moved by an issue that you had to do something about it?
1970, the indigenous people in North America who were protesting a lot of things, including their salmon rights that were being damaged by dams being put in and their cultural heritage and land being taken away. So that was my first arrest, was with Native Americans up in Tacoma, Washington.
In came Jane Fonda with her entourage. We climbed over the fence. And then the military was unleashed.
That's when I really realized that I had a special responsibility because I was a celebrity. When I realized what it meant to have my presence there among all those tribal nations that were protesting.
But in the past, you've talked about how, as a young woman, you were the daughter of Henry Fonda. You are the daughter of Henry Fonda. There were certain expectations of you as a woman. And how did activism fit into those expectations?
Well, believing in standing up for the underdog, that was part of my upbringing. I mean, look at the films my father made, Grapes of Wrath, 12 Angry Men, The Wrong Man, The Oxbow Incident. Those were the films that he loved, and they were about fairness and justice.
There are 11 votes for guilty. I won't stand alone. We'll take in a guilty verdict to the judge right now.
All right, let's do it the hard way.
That sounds fair. Everyone agreed? Anyone doesn't agree?
But you see, the thing about the Vietnam War, it was a generational struggle. So there was a lot of intergenerational clashing. I remember when he went over, my dad did, over to Vietnam with the USO, you know, the entertainers who go over and entertain the troops. He was invited to do that. And when he came back, the thing he kept talking about was there are no battle lines. You don't know where the enemy is. He was just flummoxed by that fact. But he was just worried that I was going to get in trouble like celebrities had in the 50s when they spoke out.
Are you, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I should like to see what you have.
Well, you will pretty soon.
You know, I'm a person of privilege. And when I realized that what I wanted to do with my life was to put my body on the line for issues that I felt were important that I could help with. The more that they attacked me, the more I dug in my heels and moved forward with resolve.
Put your body on the line is important there, because it wasn't just making speeches, and not to say that there's anything wrong with just making speeches, or it wasn't just donating money. I mean, most famously, you went to North Vietnam, you went to Hanoi, and you, when you did that, what were you hoping to accomplish just by going there?
The only reason I went was to prove that the United States was trying to destroy the earthen dikes of North Vietnam. It's like Holland. It's below sea level, the Red River Delta is. And if the dikes were destroyed, according to the Pentagon Papers, hundreds of thousands of people would die from drowning or starvation. And we were bombing the dikes. And it stopped about a month or two after I came back. And I'm proud of that. But that's why I went.
You know, when you come back, I mean, there's the famous photo of you sitting on an anti-aircraft gun, smiling with North Vietnamese soldiers.
That seemed a bit tactless. What were you doing behind an enemy gun?
I didn't think at the time about how it would be received, and I can understand why people were very confused by that. The soldiers received me there and sang me a song. And I was applauding their song, and this is what was shown on American television.
Not only that, but, you know, when I first came back from Hanoi, there was maybe 1 inch of newsprint in the New York Times about it. It was no big deal. It wasn't until a bit later that they decided to create this myth of Hanoi Jane.
Hanoi Jane would henceforth rank right up there with World War II enemy propagandists Tokyo Rose and Axis Sally.
Which would deter future anti-war activists for doing things as I did, because look what will happen to you.
The petition we're circulating asks the Justice Department to prosecute Jane Fonda to the fullest extent of the law.
I don't care if she's a tender young female, a famous movie star, that is treason.
To which I say, well, really? I'm still here. Mm. And where are you all? You know?
You did apologize for it.
Yeah, it was a terrible, thoughtless, irresponsible thing to do. I mean, I did it. It was not an active gun. There were no planes in the air. Nothing was happening. But I realized that the image belied everything that I am. I believe in nonviolent civil disobedience. I don't believe in shooting and dropping bombs. So it was a terrible mistake, and it was thoughtless.
The reason I bring that up is not to relitigate something from 50 years ago, but is that in this current time, there's a lot of conversations in activism about the idea of having to be perfect. You have to be perfect all the time. And I think what I find interesting about that moment, and I hope you can speak to it, is that you're allowed to make mistakes, that you're allowed to apologize and still be an activist.
Yes. First of all, never let perfect get in the way of good. The fact that I went to North Vietnam and brought back photographic evidence of the bombing and that it attracted attention to the bombing was more important than the bad, which was the fact that I was photographed on the anti-aircraft carrier.
How are you not? I mean, there's a certain conversation right now that's, especially when musicians speak up, you hear, why don't you stick to music, or why don't you stick to acting if they're speaking up about these things? What do you say to these people?
First of all, forget them. Just don't even pay any attention. But here's the deal. You know what a repeater is? These are the antenna at the top of mountains. Their purpose for being up there is to pick up weak signals down in the valley. They don't create the signals in the valley, but they pick them up and repeat them, sending them out to a much wider audience. That's what celebrities do. We're repeaters. We can lift the voices of people who don't get heard, that know the truth and are on the front lines, and allow more people to hear them. And that's what happened with Fire Drill Fridays. So many young people, so many people of color, indigenous people, largely women and girls, were heard because celebrities introduced them.
More from Jane Fonda and Tom Powers' conversation right after this. Here's the rest of Tom Power and Jane Fonda's conversation right now.
I want to talk more about the celebrity side of this, but I want to continue to talk a little bit also about the repercussions of speaking up that you faced, especially during that time. Just take a listen to this.
Jane Fonda. What in the world is the matter with Jane Fonda? I feel so sorry for Henry Fonda, who's a nice man. She's a great actress. She looks pretty. But, boy, she's off on a wrong track.
Jane, what did we just hear?
Richard Nixon.
What did you think when you heard that for the first time?
Well, I'd read it. I'd been into the files. You know, when I wrote my memoirs, I got a hold of all the tapes and the files. So I knew that he said it.
You were arrested re-entering the U.S. from Canada. Am I right?
That's right. That was when I was arrested on, according to the arresting officer, he said that I'm doing this on orders from the White House. Yeah. I was carrying vitamins and they said they were drugs and so, and yeah.
And it was bad. I mean, your family was concerned for your safety. A lot of actors distanced themselves from you. The media treated you like a traitor. There were protests with people holding up Hanoi Jane placards.
Jane Fonda is an outrageous liar.
How did you make peace with how you were treated? And most importantly, how do you come out of that situation not being cynical?
Cynicism is what I hate the worst. I don't tolerate it in myself or anybody else. I'm not cynical. But here's the thing. You never want to be an activist by yourself. You always want to be embedded in an organization or in a movement, surrounded by people who with whom you share values and share goals. And that was the case for me. I was part of a movement. You know, we didn't have very much money. I lived in a house with other activists. I mean, there were a lot of us living in the same house. That's what we did in those days. We weren't, all, you know, we were in our 30s and we were relatively poor. And so I always had people around me. I was never alone. And that's what made it possible to withstand the assaults that were coming at me. You know, I knew who I was. They couldn't tell me who I was. They being the administration and the, you know, the right wingers. And as long as I was solid in who I was and why I had done what I had done, and I was in the bosom of a movement, I was fine.
But you know, you were in the bosom of a movement and you were using your art. I mean, we're talking a lot about, you know, your protests and activism and organizing, but you actually used your art. I mean, you look at Fun with Dick and Jane, you look at a Coming Home. How did you incorporate your values and your activism actually into your career in Hollywood?
Well, I was, for a number of the early years of my activism, my celebrity, I found it problematic. You know, unlike most, this is where I'm different than a lot of celebrity activists. I'm on the ground. I was on the ground a lot in different parts of the country. I was at the Superfund sites. I was in the factories of Detroit talking to organizers. I was on Indian reservations and so forth. So the celebrity kind of separated me from the people that I was working with. You know, I always felt like an outlier. And one day I had a friend, he was a black lawyer in Detroit. He was the head of the Revolutionary League of Black Lawyers. Ken Cockrell was his name. And he said to me, he was like my mentor at the time. And he said, I think I'm going to quit Hollywood and become just a full-time organizer. And he said, Fonda, wait a minute. We have, the movement has plenty of organizers. We don't have movie stars. Not only should you stay in the industry, you should pay more attention to career, be more intentional about your career. And that's where I decided to start making movies that were about things that I cared about. Fun with Dick and Jane and Coming Home.
You know, you want to be a part of it, get your licks in with the US of A. And when you get over there, you grow up real quick.
China Syndrome.
Hello, this is Kimberly Wells, and I'm here at the Ventana Nuclear Power Plant.
9 to 5, etc.
9 to 5 is interesting. 9 to 5, of course, like one of the finest films, you and Lily Tomlin and Dolly Parton, a song that still gets played on the radio all the time. And I remember watching it when I was a kid, and watching it when you're older is a little bit different because you see it a little bit differently. You see it tackling, you know, women's issues like, you know, equal pay and flexible work. Did you have any sense at the time that that film would be revolutionary?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my best friends from the anti-war movement, her day job was organizing secretaries. Her name is Karen Nussbaum. Karen, when I was with her, would tell me stories about secretaries. And that's when I said, I got to make a movie about this.
Couldn't we just all get together and complain? Complain to who?
Let's face it, we are in a pink collar ghetto. Let's have another drink.
I just find that so interesting because it does feel sometimes, Jane, like there's a choice you have to make to either be an activist on the street or to show it through your art.
I want to do both. The reason that those films worked was because I had spent time with the kind of people that we were concerning ourselves with. Coming home, for example, I spent years talking to military wives, women whose husbands had gone overseas and come back unrecognizable. I knew those men. I talked to hundreds of them and the women who were married to them. And I could bring that to Coming Home. The same with the other movies. I was familiar with the people.
One of the conversations we're having a lot on this show is about fashion, specifically around sustainability in fashion and fashion and climate change. And you're an interesting point in this because at the last Oscars, you showed up wearing a six-year-old gown and you declared it was part of a bigger plan not to buy new clothes. Have you been able to hold yourself to that one?
Now, I have to say I've not changed shape so I can wear clothes that I wore 20 years ago. And so I have a lot of clothes, but I'm never going to buy new clothes again, no.
What spurred that decision?
Consumerism. We have to walk our talk. If we are against consumerist society and that contributes to global warming. See, when I grew up, it wasn't that way. Consumerism wasn't what it is today. It just wasn't that important to have a brand, be wearing a brand, and so on and so forth. And I read that Greta Thunberg is part of Stop Shop. I'd never heard that word before. And I looked into it, and I decided I was going to do that too.
Interesting. I want to close out like this. There are a lot of activists who have expressed great despair over the climate and anxiety about the future. But you who have been through dark times before, you know, you were through dark times with Vietnam, you were dark times throughout your career. I want to go back to something you said. You said, cynicism is the thing I like the least in the entire world, but I think it takes work. So how do you keep hopeful and what keeps you hopeful?
Well, getting older takes work. And getting older really helps because been there, done that, you know. Things have been bleak before. We survived. We got through. How did we get through? Staying active. When I start getting depressed, I know that the best antidote to depression is activism. When you put yourself on the line, the depression disappears. You know, I've been arrested before. Well, I've been arrested for civil disobedience, but this was very deliberate. You know, this was the first time, this fire drill Friday, the 4 months in D.C. before we went virtual. It was like my idea. And I didn't rely on some guy to give me the narrative. I kind of owned it. So when the first day that I was standing on the steps with 15 other people holding our placards and chanting, I felt so good. It was like stepping into myself. When you're putting your whole body on the line for something that you believe in, when you're fully aligned with your deepest values, first of all, it's hard to do that in this day and age. And when you do, there is such a feeling of empowerment. And I realized that the other 14 people felt the same way. And on the last day, 4 months later, when there were 350 people standing on the steps I could see in their faces, they all felt that. And it included a bunch of celebrities, Joaquin Phoenix and Martin Sheen and Susan Sarandon and lots of others.
Putting yourself on the line is the key to being hopeful. That's a beautiful way to end it. Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you.
From 2020, that was Tom Power and Jane Fonda's conversation. And you know what? I actually showed my hairdresser a picture of Jane Fonda's mugshot a few years ago. Because, like, even in a mugshot, Jane Fonda's got great hair. Anyways, that's it for the Q interview today. Thanks for listening. And hey, why not rate and review the podcast? I'm Caitlin Swan, the producer of this thing, sitting in for Tom Power while he's away on holiday. Okay, now I'm going to do my best Tom impression here. We'll see you next time on the Q interview later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.